This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, a critique of the recent national prison strike. A veteran activist says the strike's organizers failed to consult local people on the ground. A California prisons activist addresses the difference between prison abolition and prison reform. And we'll talk to the author of a new book on how to be less stupid about race.
But first, Brett Kavanaugh, President Trump's nominee to be the next justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, had a hard time during last week's Senate confirmation hearings. One of the many Americans that was glued to the television was Kevin Alexander Gray, the activist and author from Columbia, South Carolina. Gray says, even when the subject of contention is women's rights, the subtext in America is race.
Whoever the Republicans and conservatives put on the court is always about white supremacy. They want a judge that will overturn Roe v. Wade because white folk in America are worried about their survival, about having enough kids to maintain power and to maintain this idea of white supremacy. That's what it's all about. That's what it's always been about, to control populations, the others, as best you can, while having enough people to assume power and to maintain power. So Kavanaugh is the perfect example of the kind of judge that they want. He comes out of Federalist Society. He talks about this idea of settled law, but there's no such thing as settled law. If that was the case, we'd all still be in chains, literally, instead of figuratively. But the hearings exposed, once again, the hypocrisy of America, the hypocrisy of the Republican Party, the hypocrisy of white males whose sole aim is to maintain white supremacy and white male supremacy.
And of course, the Federalist Society has had a lock on all the Republican nominations for a long time. This is not a Trump phenomenon.
No, I mean, the Federalist Society has been around, I believe, since Ronald Reagan. I think Bruce wrote a really excellent piece about how the judges have come up through the Federalist Society and through the Republican Party ranks or through the Republican Party political machine. So, as I said, when you looked at the Kavanaugh hearings, it was totally partisan. The one, I can't call it a good thing, but the one thing that really came out in the testimony of Dr. Ford was the idea that the Republican Party and through Kavanaugh's testimony have bred a group of lawyers to maintain power and to change the Constitution and to change the course of this country.
Well, of course, the Federalist Society, most of its members say they believe in original intent, the original intent of the founding fathers, most of whom were slave owners and all of whom were white supremacists.
Absolutely. And when blacks were declared 3/5 human for tax purposes, it is about the same issues that we have fought about since the origin of this country. It's about white supremacy and maintaining white power. That is the cut and dry of it. You can't put that in 750 words or 1,000 word thesis. It's the nature of this country. So when you've got judges that are talking about original intent, you're talking about even going back and attacking the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment. It's about the idea that Africans should never have been citizens or had the right to vote, or women shouldn't have had the right to vote. So no question, unless people get organized and wake up and open their eyes as to what's going on in this country. I mean, the country has always had a government that protected white power at every level. But for me, it's about people paying attention to what's going on at the local level in these gubernatorial races, because reapportionment's coming up. And the way we got into this mess is through Republican Party gerrymandering, and to some degree, the Republican Party cutting deals with black elected officials so that you had more black elected officials in state legislatures, but you had less power.
Well, of course, in its actual workings, the Federalist Society pays a lot more attention to corporate law than to issues of original intent. And its interpretation of the law always comes down on the side of the property holder.
America is based on this idea of property rights. So even when you argue, when slavery was argued, it was argued on the basis of property rights, people as property, workers as property, that property in and of itself has constitutional rights. That's the whole idea behind Citizens United. So it's about who owns the property and who controls the property. It is still the struggle of corporatism, capitalism, and workers' rights, and to some degree, socialism. It's always about the people versus the powerful.
The Democrats have also talked about their fear that the new Supreme Court justice will give even more power to a president. But the Democrats in Congress have, in fact, been heaping more powers on presidents, even as they excoriate the president that's in office.
Well, that's the central problem with all of it. You have people in Congress, people running for office who will protect the expansion of presidential power because they hope one day to have it. It's like when people ask, why did so many people fight in the Civil War? Well, there are people that one day hope that they would have slaves. So they fought to defend their privilege or their stolen privilege, if that's the word we can use, to own other people. The idea of protecting the rights of the wealthy, and you see a lot of people vote against their interest. They vote in the interest of the corporations because somewhere deep down inside, they think that one day they may be a millionaire. So they're defending something that they may never see.
That was author and activist Kevin Alexander Gray speaking from Columbia, South Carolina.
Ifeel Wangaza is an activist and attorney based in Greenville, South Carolina, where she's director of the Malcolm X Center for Self-Determination. The center also operates radio station WMXP. Wangaza has been organizing around prison issues in South Carolina since 1978. She's critical of the leaders of the recent national prison strike conducted from August 21st to September 9th. Wangaza says the organizers failed to consult with local activists, either inside or outside the prison walls.
The focus of the Free South Carolina movement organizing has been on truth building, community building, as it has been for a number of years. And it has successfully and intentionally focused on statewide agreements for the elimination of all hostilities, recognizing the fact that unless and until the differences between the brothers and sisters incarcerated in South Carolina prisons are addressed and a safe environment, communication among themselves is established and maintained, that none of the other demands and goals that they have can be reached. So that is the significant and core difference between the national goals and the local goals and demands. The demand that the state provide the necessary resources, education, rehabilitation, medical care, so as to change the dynamic between individuals in the system is a major, major demand contributing to the larger goal of ending hostilities, which the state orchestrates and manipulates.
And you've observed in other states that national strike organizers were not necessarily dealing with long-standing prisoner organizations.
That's right. As a result of my own activities over the past 30-plus years, I'm in communication with activists across the country, and a common complaint has been, one, that the national, for lack of a better term, national strike leaders have not respected, acknowledged, affirmed, worked with those who have been engaged in prison community building over the years. One. Two, in addition to that, when we look at Free Alabama Movement, which calls the earliest of the most recent strikes, successfully called, as I might add, their voice was completely lost. We cannot help but wonder whether or not, because the work has in large measure been being done by Black folks and other people of color, that the white spokespersons who have emerged and presenting themselves as the authority on prison matters are not themselves manifesting levels of white supremacy and crushing local campaigns, local activism, organizers, organizations, as opposed to enhancing and strengthening the hand of those long-standing entities, and indeed the most directly impacted communities and voices, contrary to their representation.
Now, you've been skeptical about the reports issued by the national strike organizers in terms of effectiveness, but you're not saying that that national strike and other activities are not in order.
We believe that national strike activities are critical. We know that one of the beauties of George Jackson and was to be able to organize broadly. His activities generated a national response. We know that since the 60s, when people went to prison, whether they were just nonviolent direct action folks, sit-ins and such, continued to politicize. In fact, that's how the prisons became involved and were one and the same with the civil rights movement, human rights movement. We are saying now, as we said then, that the local people must decide, and it's the linkage of the local people one to the other that builds a healthy, sustainable chain, and that anything short of that is little more, if anything, than a paper tiger.
Well, we've got about 11 months before Black August comes around again. What kind of work do you think needs to be done in the interim?
One of the things that has to happen with regard to Black August is that we have to broaden the participation and the focus of Black August. Black August has come to focus exclusively on political prisoners, prisoners of war and political exiles, and it is essential that their contribution, their heroism, be acknowledged, respected, honored, celebrated, and that they are our standard bearers. We have to also recognize the prisoners of politics, the brothers and sisters across the country who resisted in an uninformed and even in some instances, self and other destructive ways, especially those who have transformed themselves in the same way that Malcolm and George Jackson and others transformed themselves and became servants of the people. So we have to more broadly popularize, and as a member of the National Black August Organizing Committee, we have begun to have that discussion and to develop strategies to do just that.
Since Attica, prisons have become far more oppressive places, far more difficult to organize, far easier to isolate leadership inside and to keep folks on the inside isolated from folks outside.
That's true to some extent. However, because of the cell phones, that has begun to be defeated. One. Two, I think that people are being less shamed, and that's a part of the expansion and the diversification of the prison movement, that we who are most directly impacted by mass incarceration are no longer allowing ourselves to be intimidated and shamed into silence, that we are beginning to pick up our heads, to lift up our heads and say, there's something wrong with this picture, particularly as it relates to drugs. We see the inconsistency exhibited with regard to the sale of drugs, marijuana in particular. On one side of the country, you've got California that's expunging all records, that are reducing sentences, that is legalizing the sale of marijuana. We see white folks getting rich on one side, and on the other side, we see black folks going to prison for life for the same activities. So it's like that glaring inconsistency that we had and benefited from with the white and colored signs. The response to the so-called opioid epidemic, you know, when it was crack, it was a crime. When it's opium, it's a health issue. Well, the process is the same in both the black and the white communities, especially when you look at our children in these so-called desegregated schools. The first thing they want to do is they want to put them on Ritalin or some other psychotropic drug and stick them in some warehouse them in some one room or alternative, so-called alternative school, so they don't have to deal with them until they push them out of the school. And once they push them out of the school, then they no longer have access to the prescription drugs that's been imposed on them. When we look at opioids, they use a similar argument with a different result. And that similar argument is that these people started off on prescription drugs, and then when they could no longer get those prescription drugs, then they went on illicit drugs. But for white folks, it's a health problem. For black folks and brown folks, it's a crime. So again, we have that glaring inconsistency that is waking people up and moving people to action against this kind of violence against us and responding to it. So we have churches who, at one point, when we would go and talk to the minister, who would say, you know, I have members who have children in prison, but we don't have a prison ministry, who are now beginning to recognize that they have an obligation to not only those members, but to those members' children. And it's more than just going to the prison and making a sermon and serving communion, but it has to do with creating a community, a healthy community, where the young people are protected against the snares and traps of the system of white supremacy.
So you seem to be saying that the political environment, certainly in the black community on the outside, is now more conducive to prison support activity.
That's right. Openly supportive of the excessive telephone calls, the great distances that families have had to travel in order to visit and to maintain contact, has always been supported at some level in some way by the community. But now the community is coming out publicly and not only continuing that support, but also challenging the necessity of it. Why does the state of South Carolina call for $19 million above and beyond its regular budget, and at the same time plan to use that $19 million to further militarize the prisons with cell phone jamming equipment, $900,000 a year for subscription services to jam it by companies like AT&T and Verizon, putting up golf netting at $50,000 per prison, which is that golf netting scam has already been defeated, the threats send up to 250 folk out of state as far away as Wyoming, with having sent folk to Mississippi and Tennessee already, forcing folk to do video conferencing, video visitation, both in and out of the state at the expense of the families. They have become so burdensome that folk will no longer tolerate them.
That was Ifeo Wangaza of the Malcolm X Center for Self-Determination in Greenville, South Carolina.
Romarilyn Roston spent 23 years as an inmate of the California prison system. She's now the program coordinator of Project Rebound at the State University at Fullerton and serves as policy coordinator for the California Coalition for Women Prisoners. It seems that Roston has been on a mission since the moment she set foot outside the prison walls.
Well, I was on a mission prior to being released. I was on a mission from the time I entered prison, basically from county jail. I started working on ways in which I could understand the criminal justice system, understand social justice, my place, and my part in what had happened that landed me in prison serving a life sentence, and how I could help other people around me and break down the system and push back against so many people being relegated into cages. So understanding mass incarceration and doing all I can to support folks who are serving time was my mission from day one.
I'm sure that you often are asked questions about prison reform versus prison abolition.
You know, there's a fine line between the two, I think. I think they both go hand in hand, and we can't do the work inside prisons without thinking about prison abolition and how we can abolish prisons within our society. And we can't think about abolishing prisons in the society without doing the work of those who have been directly impacted now and who are living in those cages now. So both of those things need to work in concert with one another, I believe. So prison reform is, for me, about doing all that we can to address the conditions of those who are disenfranchised now while they're serving sentences, whether it's working on voter restoration or conditions of prison, addressing reentry, you know, providing work training and education for those inside, and also figuring out ways to push policy across the lines of prison reform and sentencing reform and those sorts of things. And at the same time, the abolition is working on ways to do away with the prison system, working on mental health issues and ways that other people who may commit crimes inadvertently because they have mental illness or they are living in abject poverty or under extreme conditions of trauma. And so they cross those blurred lines because we don't understand the laws in our community. And some people are over-policed because of gender, race, and class, that we think about ways to abolish prisons and incarceration at the same time. So that's just kind of where I sit. I kind of sit in the middle of that. I work towards prison abolition as well as working on reforms through policy, through creating better conditions for those inside, through visiting, working with grassroots organizations that advocate for prisoners' rights.
You've been to prison and you've made your voice heard, but do you think that the larger society pays enough attention not only to what people who are in prison or who have been to prison have to say about the system, but also to the population that is most targeted for imprisonment, that is, Black and brown people?
I think that now in 2018, there's been enough movement work done where the larger society, a mainstream society, is starting to take notice that folks who are incarcerated or who have served time or who've had any kind of justice involvement have stories that need to be heard about the punishment system that we have in America and what has led to mass incarceration and overrepresentation of Black and brown people in cages across this country. I think we're, because of organizations like Just Leadership USA, Initiate Justice, California Coalition for Women Prisoners, higher education programs like Project Rebound, Underground Scholars, and many, many more organizations who have been around for decades. All of Us or None, a new way of life reentry program in Los Angeles. We're starting to do work in areas where we've come out of the streets and now we're in the capitals. And we're talking to legislators and we're talking to philanthropists and people who have money and power are now hearing our stories and starting to hire us and incorporate us into their mission. And so we're not a forgotten population anymore. We're moving to the table of some very important conversations. And so we're changing the narrative and shifting the way that people think about mass incarceration, those who have served time. But we're still fighting against a huge machine called mass media that continues to depict people like me who have been incarcerated or people who are still incarcerated as monsters and undeserving of our second chance. And so it's very hard work, but we're in it to win it.
We just saw the end of a prison strike that affected a number of facilities across the country. And of course, the state did everything it could to muffle those voices from inside the walls.
That's true. It's hard for incarcerated people to get their voices heard inside the prison. So to have information coming out of the prison into the free world is very difficult because prisons are isolated areas. What goes on in prisons are supposed to stay in prisons, and that has been the problem for centuries. And so now that light is being shined on prison conditions and what's happening to incarcerated and formerly incarcerated people, and the restoration of those rights being pushed by organizations on the ground and legislation, we're starting to see things change. And so the prison strike was able to gain some ground because it got some media attention, which was really fabulous. But still, because of the policies and practices of prisons and jails and the surveillance and monitoring that goes on of people inside those places and spaces, it's hard to get the word out. So we don't really know what happens. We don't really know. We know a small portion of those things. But because of people who survived that captivity, we're able to explain more to the general public of what happens in those places. And so now through access to telephone calls and writing letters and more organizations being approved to go inside prisons and jails across the country, we're able to have face-to-face conversations with those serving that time, and we're able to then advocate for them. And so we're starting to learn more and more through that advocacy. But yes, prison officials normally and typically want to keep those spaces hidden from the public. We have to continue to push and push and push and make sure that the public has access to those spaces, because it is our public dollars that pay the salaries of those prison guards and prison staff and prison administrators. And so we should have a say and have access to those places.
Yes, a lot of what we do know about what goes on in prisons today is because of cell phones, and prison administrators are going out of their minds trying to stamp out cell phone use behind the bars.
Exactly. You know, we see that because, you know, these phones are magnificent devices. They have the capability of recording not only audio, but video. Very good audio, very good video, capture very clear pictures. And so we need to have access to those things and the internet so that our families and friends know that we are safe. These are not safe environments, and it's not always the incarcerated people that are the monsters inside. Many prison officials abuse and violate incarcerated people. And there should be some type of oversight for us, some type of protection for us inside those cages. And cell phones is a good use of that. And the internet is a good use of that, so that we can send emails to people immediately when things are happening in our lives. And we don't have to go through the snail mail like we used to do when I was incarcerated and that mail being reviewed and censored by numerous mailroom staff and prison guards before it even left the prison, if it left the prison. So cell phones are something that we need to advocate for and make sure that folks have access to getting information outside of the prison, as well as folks having access into the prison.
In terms of the sheer magnitude of the task, the U.S. prison system is off the scales globally. That is, nothing anywhere in the world compares to it. And just to return to the level of incarceration of 1970 levels of imprisonment, we'd have to let loose 3 out of 4 of the people who are imprisoned now.
Correct. And so a lot of research has been done following the trends of mass incarceration and why this elevation in the number of people in prison has happened. Prison expansion was a big part of that. Contracts to private prisons, contracts to builders, mandatory minimums, sentencing laws, all kinds of things were working together in the 70s and 80s that's brought about this. And capitalism has been pushing it. You know, if it wasn't for people seeking money, not public safety, but profit over the bodies of primarily black and brown people, we would not be in this mess today. And that's why this is a continuation of slavery. And we talk about mass incarcerations being directly linked to the 13th Amendment. And a lot of these crimes, a lot of these violations, a lot of time that people are being set up for has to do with sentencing enhancements, people being sentenced to 2 and 3 and 4 times the amount of time that they should serve because they have prior offenses or they have some type of affiliation in their past. I mean, people are not able to move on and be allowed to live a life outside of being connected to the criminal justice system once you've been involved. It is a tyrannical system that once you are in it, it is very, very difficult for you to get out. And that's why we see so many numbers. And it's gone from black and brown men to black women. And now I think one of the women have been the fastest growing population since 1980. It's grown 700 to 800% in the last 30 years. And now we're seeing Asians being the next growing population. So like I said, it's capitalism is pushing this. Immigrants, crimmigration, as we call it, those who are undocumented or non-citizens, you get in this system and it's hard to get out.
And of course, capitalism, which seeks to devour everything, is taking a big chunk of the prison business directly through private prisons.
The prison industrial complex is alive and well. I mean, if they're not exploiting our labor, as in California, through incarcerated firefighters, saving the state $100 million a year on incarcerated labor out on the fire line for $1 an hour, or folks inside state prisons in the state of California and across the country working for slave wages, which is either zero. Some people get paid nothing for their 40 hours a week or more. Some people get paid 10 cents, 17 cents, 27 cents, 36 cents, but minimum, we're talking pennies that people are getting paid to produce furniture, dairy products, meat, all kinds of clothing items for corporations, glasses, dental products. I mean, everything you can imagine incarcerated people are doing inside of these cages, and they're getting paid pennies on the dollar because they've committed some offense. And it's just unbelievable that sometimes the training that they receive and the work that they put in prisons is not transferable post-release. And so we're without jobs when we come out. We're without recognition of that work. We're without direct avenues into some of the very corporations and businesses that profit over our labor while we're inside. They don't hire us.
The Black Lives Matter movement has resurrected a kind of politics that we had not seen much of in, more than a generation in Black America, with the focus on the criminal injustice system.
It's fabulous. I was in St. Louis, Missouri in 2014 I lived just a couple blocks from Canfield Drive when Michael Brown was shot and killed by Darren Wilson. And to have that type of movement building and that type of response from the Black community and worldwide attention on the murdering of Black men in the streets, oftentimes by police officers who are in departments that are primarily all white, was a remarkable response. And so the BLM movement has generated so many positive things over the last 5 or 6 years and gotten so many people involved, not just Black and brown people, but allies across race and across this globe have come out in support of what's happening to Black lives. Just another chapter from the civil rights movement of how diabolical the system can be towards people of color. And so I do all that I can and highly support the BLM movement and Black Lives Matter. We need to focus more on education for communities of color, for low-income communities. We need to work on providing better public education for folks in communities that can't afford private school and charter schools. We have to do better. We can't be over-policing and over-surveilling our kids just because they're poor or they have a darker hue of skin tone. We need to do better by those kids, kids who have parents who've been incarcerated. We know the statistics there. We need to start building more higher education programs for those incarcerated and those being released. Higher education is the best practice, the best reentry practice to helping people get not only back on their feet, but getting careers, getting good jobs, being able to sustain their lives and their families. Higher education is education across the board, whether it's abolishing the school-to-prison pipeline by providing better services and prevention methods and tools to our young kids, especially those who have incarcerated parents, and then post-release, those who are coming out of jails and prisons, and those even in jails and prisons need to have better access to higher education to transform their lives.
Yes, Pell Grants used to be widely available in prison, but no more.
Correct. And that was due to the crime bill in 1994. But now we see through Second Chance Pell Grant that a certain number of colleges and universities were able to access that money. Here in the state of California, folks who have been justice involved don't have to check a box. And with the federal government and financial aid, it's only a small subset of folks who have drug-related crimes who can't receive Pell Grant because they were receiving financial aid when they committed that crime. So it's a small subset of folks, but it's a myth out there that if you committed a crime, if you've gone to jail or prison, that you are barred from financial aid. And so there's a lot of misinformation out there about access to higher education for formerly incarcerated people. There's a lot of myths out there about who we are as individuals. And so, again, shout out to all the organizations across the country that are doing great work to get our voices out there and our stories out there and to depict us in a humanizing way, because we are your neighbors. We do ride the bus with you. We fly on planes with you. We serve your food. You serve food to us. And yet we're not being treated with the dignity and respect that we deserve. Our taxpaying dollars come out of our checks every week, just like everyone else. And yet in many states, we don't have the right to vote. It's wrong. And it's time for this country, supposedly the greatest country in the world, to start doing right by its most vulnerable citizens.
That was California prison activist Romarilyn Ralston.
Much of today's political conversation seems to blame Donald Trump for American racism, sexism, and endless wars. That's not very smart, according to Dr. Crystal Fleming, a professor of sociology and Africana studies at Stony Brook University on Long Island, New York. Fleming is author of a new book titled How to Be Less Stupid About Race. She says, yes, Trump is a white supremacist warmonger, but so was his Democratic predecessor.
Yes, I mean, I'm 36 years old. I came to my own critique of the Democratic Party's complicity in all of this, and fascism and corruption and white supremacy, sexism. Really, pretty recently, it was during Obama's administration that I became aware of progressive critiques of the corporate Democratic Party, and that it just became so clear that there was this cynicism and this partisan pearl clutching, on the side of the Democrats about all of these issues they claimed to care about when Bush was president or, prior Republican administrations. And then when the Democrats in charge, they just don't care. And that became so glaringly obvious to me during Obama's administration, such that, now that we're in this era where, again, Democrats are pretending to care so deeply about racism or care so deeply about patriarchy and Me Too, when, it's clear to me if Hillary had won, a lot of this wouldn't be on the table.
Yes, people forget that Barack Obama, in the first days of his administration, put all entitlements, including Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security, on the table for cutting. That austerity was part of his agenda.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you could just go down the line from the neoliberalism of Obama's regime and undercutting the safety net in almost every way conceivable, to deporting, more undocumented people than any other, in fact, than more than all of the prior administrations combined, to literally honoring the Confederacy every year of his presidency, like presidents before him. I mean, you could go down the line on these issues that are either about the safety net or white supremacy or to imperialism, and just show how the hypocrisy of the Democrats and claiming to care about these things that Trump is continuing to do, but not calling out these dynamics when a Democrat is in charge. So part of what I'm trying to do with How to Be Less Stupid About Race is to write about these matters in a way that I hope is accessible, and that I hope will also bring these critiques more into the mainstream, where all kinds of corporate entities and forces collude to try to make sure that the public is either not aware and or just simply don't care about these urgent matters.
Yes, the great danger in pretending that all of these evils came in with Trump is that, well, Trump is going to leave at some point, and
yes,
if people have the impression that when he leaves, these evils leave also, they'll be dead wrong.
Yes, they'll be dead wrong. I mean, again, for me, what I write about in the book is how I came to my own awakening in many ways in regards to these issues, in regards to Democrat hypocrisy and the bipartisan investment in multiple forms of oppression. So I had been through, my first election was George W. Bush. I was in college when 9/11 happened. I didn't yet have all of the historical context and the political literacy to understand what was happening at that time. But I knew, even at 18, 19 years old, I could tell that, there was a lot of lying coming from our government. I could tell that there was a lot of misrepresentations in the media and a march to war in a way that was against my values, even at 18 or 19 years old. But what I also saw was that when the Democrat became president, who had, campaigned on supposedly wanting to end wars, I saw that we then got involved in at least 8 wars led by someone who had won the Nobel Peace Prize. I mean, I saw the hypocrisy, and it really, just really drove me to a level of outrage with our politics, that for me, what I don't understand is how people can have lived through many more election cycles than I have, and really seeing this partisan pretending to care about issues and then going back to not caring when their party's in charge. I don't understand how people live with themselves and sleep at night with this really egregious and morally repugnant level of hypocrisy. So whether it's the title, How to Be Less Stupid About Race, or whether it's just, what I hope that comes through the page, which is just, how I really feel about, not just think about, but how I feel about these issues. I really hope, again, to be writing about this stuff in a way that you know, could just get more folks to be honest about our politics.
Austerity and war and white supremacy are serious subjects. They're not funny, but you say that you hope that people get a few laughs out of your book. So tell us a funny story.
Oh, well, I don't know about a funny story, but let me say this, what I mean by, you know, being able to laugh about it. I do think that is one of the unique things about my book. I do weave together a very serious treatment of these subjects, but also with that time, a sense of satire, reflections that also involve my own experiences and laughing about my own racial ignorance and political ignorance. But also, I know being Black and growing up, not only in the Black church, which is my family, it would be completely preposterous to pretend as though being able to laugh, even in the midst of our outrage and suffering, is not a core part of the Black political tradition. So, you know, for me, I think it's important, at least in the way that I treat these issues, whether it's in my teaching as an educator or in my writing, to bring the full range of my human emotions. And I'm not going to pretend as though I go through every hour of the day renting my clothes or, you know, just bowling over in outrage. I have to laugh even when I'm crying about some of these issues. I have to maintain my sense of humor. And at the point, whether you're reading headlines or you're just hearing the absurdities, you know, that are spouted from our political leadership or just from everyday folks in the street, I have to laugh because it's just overwhelming how ridiculous, how hypocritical, and how absurd statements about our country get wrapped up as respectable or accurate. I mean, just the prevalence of Trump talks about fake news and the liberal, you know, so-called liberal media talk about fake news. But, you know, the entire propaganda machine of this country has been in the business of producing fake news from the start. So laughter is part of what keeps me sane, but it's not at all to the levity that I sometimes bring into my discussion. It's not at all to minimize the horrors, but it is to practice, again, the full range of my human emotions.
You emphasize that the work of transformational change is unceasing and intergenerational, that it's a long haul, longer than people's lives even. But doesn't that have the effect, or can't it have the effect on young people of overwhelming them, presenting the task as one that is endless and infinite and impossible for human beings to tackle?
I'm glad you asked that question. I talked about this one of my book events with Maryam Kaba, who, you know, is a well-recognized activist and organizer and educator. And someone in the audience raised their hand and said, okay, you know, you talk about how these dynamics are ongoing and the work is ongoing and we're going to, you know, it's going to outlive us, but I'm completely overwhelmed. You know, what do I do with that? And so, you know, I try to do two things in the book and in discussions about these matters. And that is to say, listen, we have to focus on what we can accomplish in our lives. We have to focus on how we can translate our awareness or our consciousness raising into concrete actions for social transformation and political change. But at the same time, what I'm also responding to is the really simple-minded and inaccurate notion that I sometimes see in some anti-racist circles, folks will, you know, hold up signs or say things like, we can end racism in our lifetime. We can end white supremacy in our lifetime. And I think that when folks say things like that or imply that there is some kind of easy solution to something that has been centuries in the making, I think it really betrays the fact that so many folks have, and including well-meaning people, have an extraordinarily superficial understanding of not just racism, but oppression and what it would actually mean to undo, again, these dynamics that have been centuries in the making and that have structured and will continue to structure our economy, our politics, even, you know, our cognitive maps, how we see each other, how we see ourselves, and how we relate to each other. Domination writ large is a very overwhelming topic, but I try to balance sort of an awareness of how the work is ongoing. You're not going to magically fix all these things. Even in working together and organizing with others, we can bring about extraordinary change, but that doesn't mean we actually have to pretend as though we can wave a magic wand and these problems go away. So in my own personal life, it is a constant balancing between that awareness and at times feeling overwhelmed, because when you care about oppression, when you care about these issues, I don't know how you can make it through without sometimes feeling overwhelmed, because the level of suffering on a global scale is quite great. But I always then come back to, all right, there's my circle of concern. There's what I'm concerned about. And then there's my, this is Stephen Covey's distinction between the circle of concern and your circle of influence. Where can I actually influence, whether it's policies or practices in my own backyard, in the institutions I work in my neighborhood, in my social network. And there's a lot we can do. So Maryam Kaba, again, to go back to that book event, she emphasized that as well, that at the end of the day, although we might feel overwhelmed and that's normal, we have to come back to what can I do in my lifetime and not put the weight of the world on our shoulders, because we're not going to fix everything. And that's fine. We don't have to. We're part of an extraordinarily long struggle.
And these days, what is the stupidest thing that people seem to think about race?
I would start with basic racial denial and the denial of racism. It's amazing that we have to say this in 2018, but that remains one of the most really intentionally ignorant misconstrues of social and political reality. And it boggles the mind, the absurdity that's involved in that denial. I was seeing headlines about, this Republican politician who had called Obama the N-word and then defended it, saying that it wasn't racist. It's not. And, this is something that I had on my social media. I tweeted, I think, some weeks ago saying, I'm sure we will soon see white supremacists and white nationalists saying that they can call Black people the N-word and there's nothing racist about it. I mean, that's just, it's par for the course for the epistemological ignorance, to use critical race philosopher Charles Mills's phrase, but the epistemological ignorance and just pathological lying that's endemic to white supremacy. So, of course, that's mostly white folks, but there are people of color and Black people as well who also do not realize that systemic racism actually exists. I mean, you can look at public opinion polls. There is not, 100% of African-Americans who say, oh, yes, I'm aware that systemic racism exists or white supremacy exists. There is a subset of our community that is also complicit in that denial. So I think that is, unfortunately, one of the most urgent forms of ignorance, and it's often intentional misrepresentation to really attack. And then the other, for Black folks and people of color, is the idea that we can be, socialized in this racist white supremacist system and be untouched by it, that somehow internalized oppression is somebody else's problem. We're all, mired in this pathological system. And I think that it's really important, again, to acknowledge that, no matter how woke you think you are or how conscious you think you are or you actually are, at the end of the day, that work of decolonization, that involves everybody. There's no one who's African-American or a person of color who is somehow magically exempt from the dynamics of internalized oppression, simply by virtue of being exposed to a system that daily institutionalizes white supremacy and anti-Blackness, not just as ideas and ideologies, but as everyday practices, the normalization of state violence against indigenous people, right, who are the ongoing victims of settler colonialism. I have seen, unfortunately, African Americans continue to believe that we are somehow removed from that dynamic as well. But, to the extent that you normalize the system, then you're also normalizing settler colonialism and the atrocities and genocide that make that possible. So again, I think that to your point, and as I try to explain in the book, nobody's exempt from these really horrific ideas and practices. And I think it's important that we are honest about our collective complicity and responsibility for growing out of it and really taking action to bring about less harm in this world.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.